We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Rafi Farber, author of The Endgame Investor. Thanks for joining me today, Rafi.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here again.
Great to have you back, and always great to speak with you. So with the price action in gold that we've been seeing, how are you keeping sane and how are you trying to make sense of it all?
Well, the first thing I tell my subscribers, and I tell myself really, because really I'm really talking to myself and I'm talking to my subscribers, is that, first of all, I don't know everything. And I don't know daily price movements. I don't know weekly price movements. I don't even really know monthly price movements. All I know for sure is that gold is money. The dollar is a money substitute. And money substitutes are inflated up the wazoo and they are in the process of dying. And we can see that through all the shortages that are coming through all the angles of the economy that we think of, especially in raw materials and energy, and this is happening. So how I keep sane is I make sure I have a level of cash. And no, I'm not a fan of fiat cash or dollars or anything, but I understand that. And I've been through this several times already. I've been a gold bug and a gold analyst since I discovered Ron Paul in 2011, 2012. So it's taken me almost 10 years to come to terms with these emotional realities. But in order to keep your sanity, especially in times like these, when gold goes down, in times when we would expect it to just skyrocket up, you need cash. Mm-hmm. You need to have that emotional stability to tell yourself that when it goes down, in times when it doesn't make sense to you or anybody with any modicum of knowledge of the monetary system for real, that you need to be able to buy the dip. Because if you can't do that, you'll be thrown out of the game, especially if you're on leverage. So the way I keep sanity is, months ago, when I saw that the bullish news of, you know, let's say the Democrats winning both the House and the Senate, and we knew that they were going to spend money until, you know, the end of the world, however you want to say it, it wasn't bringing gold to new highs. So I started getting out of core positions until I had a certain level of cash. It doesn't mean that I was liquidating everything, not by any stretch of the imagination, but making sure that if we go into another liquidity crisis, which we've seen in 2008, we've seen it in 2020, we even saw it in 2000, you know, with the dot-com crash, which took 2 years to play out. And every time it happens, it happens more extreme and quicker and in less time. So the question is there going to be another liquidity crisis? My answer is yes, but at some point, the liquidity crisis is going to lead to rising gold, which it did in the late 1970s, instead of falling gold. The question that we're all asking ourselves is the next liquidity crisis going to lead to a 2020-type crash or a 1978 to 1980-type explosion? And anyone who says that they can answer that question for sure and they know the answer is fooling themselves, because we don't know. We need that cash to be able to buy the dip in case there's another, you know, there's another temporary deflationary liquidity crisis, which I'm pretty sure will be even more extreme and take less time than it did in 2020, which was about 2 weeks. It might be a week, because how long really is it going to take the Fed to step in this time? They've already got their fingers on all the triggers and they're ready to do everything, even in a day or two. It's not going to take long, but you've got to have the cash to be ready for it.
So when we're thinking about not only gold, but let's say proxies for gold, are you seeing some selling exhaustion in the leading miners?
I was yesterday in Newmont and Barrick. Those are the ones that I'm following most closely, and those are my biggest positions. I don't think it's any secret to, like, you know, give that out, because it's conservative, makes sense. I don't take any crazy risks or anything on explorers or anything like that. I do have some positions in them, but, you know, I try to be rational, and it's very rational to be most focused on these two miners because they're the biggest ones in the sector. So yesterday I saw some selling exhaustion in Barrick and Newmont. And what we can be sure of is these two companies are doing very well Newmont a little bit better than Barrick, and I'm more biased to Newmont. But they have stable dividends. They're making money. Their stock prices can go down. Obviously, we've seen it before. And when they do, their dividends are not going to go down. I don't think that either of these companies are going to cut their dividends anytime soon, because the gold price is what, 1720, 1730 now. And it's these companies are profitable even at like $1,600, $1,500 gold. They're in no danger of any type of financial problems or anything like that. So my thought is that when there is selling exhaustion, the institutional players, when they want to start into this sector, they're going to go into those two stocks first, because there's nowhere else for them to go. These are the highest liquidity stocks. And these are the ones that should reverse first. And we saw a little bit of buying exhaustion yesterday. Now we're seeing a little bit of reversal. It can go up and down and up and down until we get to a final bottom. Exactly when that is, I can't tell you, just like nobody can. But those are the two stocks I'm watching for that sign. And it's going to come.
So just a little bit for some perspective, we're speaking on the afternoon of the 29th.
Right.
But what is the gold to commodities ratio also kind of telling you at this time, Rafi?
So that's interesting. The gold to commodities ratio, that will tell you how many units of a commodity index, let's say the CRB or the GNX or whatever commodity index you want to take, how many units of commodities you can buy with 1 ounce of gold. And we are now in the midst of, since when oil hit what it was, negative $35 a barrel in April 2020, and everybody thought that was impossible. And any time before April 2020, you would have said, of course, it's impossible. Oil can't go to negative $35 a barrel, and we all saw it. So from that point on in financial insanity until now has been the biggest correction of gold in commodity terms since we went off the gold standard. It ties with the 1975-1976 correction in commodity terms. And you know, to say that this is a record is not that much of a stretch, considering that we're counting it from when oil was negative 35. So yeah, from that point until now, to say that gold has fallen in commodity terms in the strongest way since 1975 is definitely true. And if you were trading in the 1970s, or you look into that history, you know, Nixon went off the gold standard finally in the last phase of it was 1973. He, we have this number in my 1971, which is true, but from 1971 to 1973, Nixon tried to put gold back on a set dollar exchange rate, and the last one was 42.22, I think, in 1973. And then we had the 1974 to 1976 bear market in gold, and you can look back at that time. And you can look at how gold was performing in commodity terms, and it was just as bad as it is now. And it ended in 1976, I think August 23rd, 1976. And from that point, gold really started outperforming commodities. And from 1976 to 1980, we all know what happened. You know, gold went up about an order of magnitude, and that's what we're all waiting for. Because we're waiting for the world to give up on the dollar, or at least to understand that the purchasing power of the dollar as it is now is impossible, which is very reflective in the fact that shortages are showing up everywhere, because all commodity markets are priced in dollars. And if every commodity is in shortage, not every single commodity, but a lot of them, especially, for example, gas in the UK, there's shortages of natural gas in the UK. There's, I think, cotton prices are at 10-year highs. All these things are showing up everywhere. And it should be that higher prices cure higher prices and bring things back into balance, but they are not, right? So we're at a point where we're in the mid-1970s, which made no sense. Why should gold fall from 1974 to 1976? It doesn't make any sense, but it did happen. So the fact that it's happening now, yeah, it doesn't make sense fundamentally, but markets don't always go by fundamentals. That's just something you have to accept as a trader. If you're the kind of person who just, focuses on his job and puts money away in gold every month and doesn't look at it, you don't have to worry about any of this stuff. Fine. But we're not in that business. We're just not. So we have to understand that fundamentals do not always push markets alone. And we're in one of those times, like in the mid-1970s, but the other thing we have to realize and we have to internalize and understand as traders is that this is going to end. This correction is going to end. And in order to get through it, you need to have the cash to have that mental stability, because we are all human beings and we're all affected by our emotions. And instead of denying them, we have to embrace them and understand them and figure out a way to stay rational in the face of them.
So when you're talking about all commodities, really going up in dollar terms, you basically determine that that's more of a symptom of the underlying sickness of the currency. Is that right?
Yes, it is the underlying sickness of the currency. And the way I try to explain it is, let's say you have a tree. I mean, this is something I talked about in one of my videos. You're growing a tree in your backyard, right? And somebody comes and it grows fruit, and somebody tries to come into your backyard every night and steal your fruit. Most of the time, if he's careful enough, he'll steal some of your fruit and you won't even notice. Like, you know, I have a fig tree in my backyard. If somebody's going to take some figs, I'm not really going to notice because I have so many figs, but I don't care. Right? And then the tree will keep producing. But the commodity here is the fig, right? And so if I'm growing figs or I'm growing commodities, and whoever is stealing my figs, right? Or the equivalent would be inflating the money supply and trying to bid those figs away from me in the market with the money that he's inflating or printing for himself and his buddies. If he's stealing too many of my figs, I'm going to start to notice. And if I start to notice, then my behavior regarding the tree is going to change. I'm going to stop taking care of it. I'm going to stop watering it. I'm going to stop fertilizing it or whatever. And I'm just going to try to pick as many figs as I can because I know that they're being stolen from me. So this is the dying currency. When people understand that their work is being taken from them, whether they understand that conceptually or not, they see that what they're earning is buying them less and less and less. And when they see that, when they see less and less fruit on the tree of their labor, they will stop working hard and they will just try to get whatever it is that they can with the labor that they can expend. And that's when the currency starts dying, because the public, you know, it's not a conscious decision. It's not like a conspiracy where the public all gets together in a meeting and says, okay, let's spend money. They just all start doing it. And this is what causes persistent shortages that do not get solved, because the market clearing price cannot meet the falling purchasing power of the currency that is being attacked by the public without them even realizing it. And that is the end of Ludwig von Mises's crack up boom.
So are you starting to see, let's say, the beginning of hyperinflation? You recently spoke about that on your channel, and you had two definitions that really popped up. So explain to us how you're seeing this situation.
Okay. So with the definition of hyperinflation, now I'm not trying to be a prophet here or telling you exactly when it's going to happen, but here's the point. The point is that hyperinflation in, let's say, popular economic terms is when consumer prices rise by a certain percentage in a certain given period of time, let's say 50% in a month or whatever. There's two problems with that. First of all, how do you measure what consumer prices are? Because everybody buys different things. Some people, let's say, if you have like a garden in your backyard, you don't have to buy food, and you have chickens and you have eggs or you have cows or whatever, you don't have to buy meat. So like, what's your inflation rate? It might be very, very low. Maybe you have to buy electricity for your barn or whatever it is. You know, it's not going to be that much. The second one is the arbitrariness of it. Why 50%? Why not 52.7%? Why not 63.8%? But I mean, all these numbers are made up by who? Experts? You know, how much do we trust experts? We can go back a year and a half and, you know, try to figure out how much we trust experts in various, contexts. It's not that much. So these definitions of hyperinflation are not scientific. So what is hyperinflation when it hits? What is it that is happening to people? Okay. So when hyperinflation really hits, what is happening is that people do not want to hold money as a monetary reserve anymore. As hyperinflation gets faster and faster and faster, you have people trying to spend more and more of it faster and faster without holding any of it for any amount of time. So when you the objective definition of a hyperinflation would not be a certain price increase over a certain period of time. It would be the point where the average consumer's desire to hold cash balances as a monetary reserve falls to zero, and they don't want to hold money as, you know, as savings or as a, you know, a rainy day fund for any amount of time at all. They just, whatever they make, they want to spend immediately on whatever that they can buy. And have we hit that point yet? No, we haven't hit that point yet, but we have hit a point where people are attacking the commodity markets and trying to buy as much as they can, as fast as they can, because they fear certain things and they'd rather have the commodities than the money. We see this in the UK right now with gas stations. And, you know, what I hear, 90% of gas stations are empty and the army is having to fill them up now. And these crazy things that we only think of like in the middle of a world war that are happening right now. And why? Because they can't hire truck drivers. Why can't you hire truck drivers? You can hire truck drivers, but the problem is you can't hit their market clearing price. It's not, you can't get high enough, because if you pay them too much money, whoever's paying them is not going to be profitable and they're going to have to shut down. So they can't meet that market clearing price, right? They can't hit whatever price they need to get all these truck drivers to move all this stuff for the UK to have gasoline. This is what hyperinflation is. It's when you can't raise prices fast enough for supply and demand to come back into balance because the monetary reserve is losing value too quickly. That's exactly what's happening.
So is that a good example, let's say, of the definition of backwardation, Rafi?
Well, yes, the definition of backwardation is a term reserved for futures markets. And I'll translate this into how it affects in the consumer markets. So in futures markets, usually futures traders are the only ones who know what backwardation is. It's something that doesn't really make sense. It's that when the prices for commodities now are more expensive than the prices for commodities later, which doesn't make sense because the prices for commodities later, if you're locking in the price now, is going to include storage, is going to include insurance, it's going to include all of those expenses. So usually futures markets for any commodity are more expensive in the future than in the present. The only reason they should be more expensive in the present is if there's a shortage of the commodity now and you need it now and you're willing to pay the premium to keep your business going. The only other reason that there should be backwardation in a commodities market is that if you have all these currency units as a futures trader and you don't want them, you'd rather have the good, right? But let's say in a Keynesian analysis, right, and you're trying to analyze what demand is and what supply is, and you're looking at a chart, you cannot tell the human action perspective difference between someone who wants a commodity now and someone who just wants to get rid of a currency now. It looks the same thing on a chart. You can't tell what's happening. You can only tell what's happening on a human action analysis of that, which is this, you know, the Austrian school, which what the Austrian school focuses on. So how I would translate this to hyperinflation or to the concept of rising consumer prices, right? So if, let's say, a future for wheat now is higher than a future for wheat later, if we're going to talk about that in terms of inflation, or what I would call rising prices more accurately, then you could say inflation expectations, let's say 6 months out, a year out, if they are higher than inflation expectations 3 years, 4 years out, that's the same as a futures commodity term structure, right? So a commodity 4 years out should be more expensive than the commodity 6 months out, which means inflation should be lower. It should be lower four or 5 years out than it is, 6 months out. But if inflation expectations 6 months to a year out are higher than inflation expectations 5-6 years out, then it's saying that people want to get rid of money faster. That's backwardation in the inflation or rising prices market itself, and that's what is happening. We're seeing short-term inflation expectations higher than long-term inflation expectations, because picture imagine someone who's actually in, you know, a Weimar economy. And you say, what's your inflation expectation 4 or 5 years out? What's he going to say? Like, who cares? Like, I need to get rid of the money now. Like, my inflation expectations for like a month out is 100%. Well, like, what are you asking me for? Who cares about 4 years? Mm-hmm. We're not there yet, but that's definitely the direction we're heading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, thinking about that, explicitly stated a little simpler would be just changing the time preference from, you know, a couple months out to right now. You have to spend that money right now to be able to still get something with it, right?
Yes. Yeah. So the point where, you know, 1 year expectations, I think they're at like 6 to 8% or now or something in the US, you know, at the, you know, for whether they go to 15-20%, okay, that would be worse. But like, if the time horizon gets shorter and shorter and the inflation expectations get higher and higher for a shorter and shorter time period, that's deeper and deeper backwardation in consumer prices. And eventually when the monetary system implodes, it's going to go to infinity. And the only way to stop that would be to back the dollar with some hard currency like gold or silver. And I don't think they're going to do that because I don't think they have the ability.
So you recently wrote about the M2 money supply growth rate falling right now. So could this factor into the equation as well, Rafi?
Well, it could. See, the problem with money supply growth factors, and I need to mention my friend and mentor, the late Bob Wenzel, the great Bob Wenzel of San Francisco. He's really the guy from the Austrian school who brought me into this stuff. And he had been following money supply since the 1970s, and he just passed away recently in May, I think. So the problem with money supply now is that back in April, May, June 2020, the money supply growth rates, because of all the printing that the Fed embarked on, became so incredibly high that it was just unprecedented. It went to a peak of about 50% annualized. And the way Bob used to calculate that was he would take the quarterly average money supply growth rate and multiply it by 4. And that would give you an annualized rate. So it went at the 50%, which means on an annualized basis, the 4 trillion would turn into 6 trillion or whatever it is. And that rate has come way, way down. Now, we don't know how much, you know, stock, who's involved in pushing these stock prices up with these bubble stocks, you know, Tesla, Amazon, whatever. We don't know how much money they have in their cash balances and how much dry powder they have left. Because the chart until about 2020, it was like, you know, up, down. And then in 2008, it went just below zero and that caused a crash. And then the same thing happened in 2015 when we saw a little bit of a crash. It went down to like about 0.5%. But now that it's gone up to like 20% in 2020, and now it's only down to like, you know, let's say, I think it's like the last number was 6.7% or something like that, somewhere around there. It's still seasonally high, but stocks have gone so parabolic since then that we don't know how much of that new money has been spent. So yeah, if the money supply growth rates go down to, I don't know, like let's say 2 or 3%, I'm just guessing, then yeah, you could have a serious liquidity crunch going on. But with the crazy changes in money supply growth rates since 2020, it's very hard to tell with these numbers of 6%. I'd have to wait for it to go much lower than that to call, you know, a stock market top or anything like that. I'm just staying away from it because I don't really understand what is going on in the stock market or who is buying what, because there's so many people involved and so many of them have no knowledge of what they're doing.
So as we talk about the Fed's actions, Rafi, two Fed presidents resigned this week, both of which were proven to have large investments in the markets. Do you think that those are related in any way? And how do you see that situation?
How do I say that situation? I just laughed. It's the first thing I did because it's like, it's so absurd. First of all, okay, I'm not complaining that they're being called out, but when big honchos like this are being called out for whatever reason, you have to ask why. Well, like somebody is behind it for some reason. It's like, it's sort of like, the Love Gov, what do you, Andrew Cuomo, like, you know, why was he being forced out for his, you know, rampant behavior that we, you know, let's not speak of it, but somebody was out for him. You see, I could say the same thing about Ray Nagin. I think the Lou Rockwell mentioned this a few years ago in 2005, he was the governor of New Orleans around Katrina. And for some reason he was forced out. You know, usually it's not like any of these people are clean. They never are. If you print trillions of dollars and buy stocks, you know, you're dirty. And everyone in the Fed buys stocks. It's like, you can't deny that any of them knows that if they print trillions of dollars, of course their assets are going to go up. So if they buy anything, if they're the ones printing the money, like, what do you expect? The question is, why these two guys? And were they especially doves, or did they insult somebody? Why are they being outed now? I really don't know. But I do find it very interesting. The only thing I could think of, and this is just speculation on my part, that it's not like, I don't believe that everybody in government is bad. There's always some good people in government. You just don't know who they are, where they are. And usually when they decide they're going to be good, they're going to try to sneak it and to try to do something without, you know, outing themselves or endangering themselves or their families. I think maybe somebody revealed something or put it to the press, some good guy in the Fed or in the Treasury or somebody who has a conscience who did this to them. And that's good. It's a good thing. It's a good thing for people to look at this and say, oh, look at that. Okay, good. Maybe there'll be more, maybe there won't. But like, let's enjoy it. That's all I can say. And what else can you say?
Absolutely. So Rafi, you know, I'd like to kind of turn back a little bit to commodities. As we were talking about, there's so many, you know, different factors that goes into the pricing of all of these goods. And in one of your recent articles, you brought up the Milton Friedman example of how everything is interconnected, and the analogy that he wrote, it was the example of a pencil. So can you give that to us, please?
Okay. So Milton Friedman's analogy of a pencil is that this good, right? It's a piece of wood that's painted, glued together with graphite in the middle and metal on the top holding an eraser in. Did the wood guy who decided to cut the wood in a certain way communicate with the graphite guy to put it in the middle, and then he called the metal guy to keep the eraser in, you know, its little case there on the top. And the eraser guy says, oh, I have just the thing for you. Did they all communicate to each other? No, not at all. It was a bunch of commodity salesmen that were looking at, you know, buying and selling prices of various goods. And then inventors who tried to put different things together and then calculate how much it would cost them to put these things together and how they could do it in a profitable way to make money so they could buy a house for themselves and their families, right? Nobody communicated about any of this. It was just markets that really did not know that they had anything to do with each other being put together by an entrepreneur who had an idea. And that was it. So what's happening now is really the reverse of the pencil case. The pencil is the free market without directly communicating different parts of it to itself, came up with the idea of a pencil because somebody wanted to make money. And now what is happening, for example, did anybody before this crisis, before these shortages, before these shortage crises in the UK, know that fertilizer production was related to CO2 production, which was related to meat production? Did anybody know that? Yeah, I'm sure isolated people in the market who understood these industries, I'm sure they knew about it. But you, in order to find this specific knowledge, and this is what Hayek talked about, F.A. Hayek of the Austrian School, this is what he talked about, the diffusion of knowledge in the market. There's no way a central body can know all this stuff, let alone even analysts like you or I that spend our time trying to figure this stuff out. You know, we're good at theory, but like, we don't know everything about every market, not even close. We just know generally how economics should work. And that's all we can say. So what is the connection between fertilizer and CO2? That if you shut down fertilizer production, you know, in fertilizer production, the byproduct is CO2. Then you don't have CO2, which is apparently useful in slaughtering animals. Who knew? Very essential for the meat industry to keep their meat product going. So now fertilizer companies are shutting down because they can't afford their cost of production, and that's cutting down the CO2 production, and that means that meat can't be produced in the same quantities that it could be. So there's going to be a meat shortage. So how do you know that a fertilizer shortage is going to lead to a meat shortage? It doesn't make sense, but it does make sense. So that's the opposite of that's the pencil breaking apart. So we're seeing these massive economic production capacities starting to shrink down, and the opposite of economic growth. And when they shrink down, you have less supply, which makes things more expensive, which makes people think that their money's losing value and faster, and it keeps the snowball going, which is where we're at now. And I see no way of stopping it. I don't.
Rafi, one of the last things I'd like to touch on here. You've been kind of chronicling or detailing, trying to take delivery of a silver contract from the COMEX. So can you tell our listeners about how you came about that idea and how that has progressed?
Yeah. I should be finding out tonight if I'm getting my warrant on my silver contract. The last I checked on my account, I'm long one September silver contract, and their deadline to give me the warrant is tonight. The first thing I'll tell your viewers is that don't go with interactive brokers. they advertised that they allow the physical delivery of contracts in terms of warrant, which would give me a legal right to the physical silver behind the contract. Until I have that warrant, I don't have the right to the physical silver. How this ended up happening is that my good friend Chris Marcus of Arcadia Economics hooked me up with one of his fans who was able to fund the contract with some other people. And this is not my money. And this is all just trust between people who believe in each other and trust each other. So this is not my money. And if I can't get the warrant, I plan to return all of it to him, this funder. So what's been happening is that Interactive Brokers has been very difficult, and I'm not saying I'm blaming them. I don't know if they even are trying to stonewall me, or if this is just the first time that they've done it, because I asked them, have you ever delivered a warrant on any physical contract to any of your clients throughout all your history? And they said, no, we've never done it before. Mm-hmm. And we're just advertising this now. So I don't know. Maybe they're just trying their best. They could be, but if you really want to take physical delivery of a contract, don't use interactive brokers for now. Maybe they'll get better in the future. Maybe they will. But you should pick a different one. I can't recommend one to you because I'm going to be trying a different one if I can't get this warrant. But if I can get it, and I will hopefully find out by tomorrow, then I will be calling the COMEX directly and trying to get loading out of that. Loading out means the actual physical delivery of that contract to someone else involved in this process. And he will do what he wants with it because it's not my money. I'm just trying to get it somewhere. And we're trying to figure it out if this can actually work. And if we can, we will report it. And if I can't, and I don't get the warrant and this whole thing falls apart, I'll report that too. And we'll know.
Well, we look forward to the hopeful delivery on the silver, Rafi. Do you have anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
Yeah. I'll just say, look, it's very difficult being a gold bug now, and it was difficult in March 2020, and it was difficult in 2008, and it was difficult from 1980 to 2000. There are times when it's difficult, but if you understand what money is, and it's the connection of every part of the market to every other part of the market, and that the way that this gold is being distributed now, which is through dollars primarily, which is a gold substitute, still a gold substitute, because it can still be exchanged for some amount of gold. That system is being poisoned. If you just keep that in your head and understand the reality of what the monetary system is, you can get through this as long as you're not leveraged and you're not gambling, and you've got a steady income and you know what's coming. you can get through it, and we're going to get through it along with the rest of the insanity in the world. And I'm sure your viewers can imply or figure out what I'm talking about. It's all connected. Everything is connected. And we will get out of this in one piece, one way or another. And I wish you all the best.
I appreciate the hopeful outlook there, Rafi. Of course, you're available on Seeking Alpha at the Endgame Investor and on Twitter as well, at Rafi Farber. Rafi, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for yours, Tom. I appreciate it also.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.